We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Quint Kesnick. Quint, happy Easter. We've got April Fool's Day in the books. The days are getting longer. The weather is getting warmer. Lacrosse season is here.
Welcome to the spring portion of the schedule. So I always like to say we're through with the winter portion. We're through with the preliminaries. Now we start playing for league championships. Now we start jockeying for position in the NCAA tournament. I thought this week, top to bottom, may have been the best of the season because you had the high-end games, you had the middle tier, some really great games. And then even down at the bottom, you had also a slew of upsets that made ranking teams 13 through 20, Terry, this week. Woo, good luck. I spent all Easter morning on that when I should have been out hunting for eggs.
Not only did we have those upsets, but we also had a bunch of really close games, which if you remember, in late February, we were lamenting all of the blowouts. So there's definitely an aspect of league competition breeds peer playing against peer, which breeds closer games. But that wasn't exactly what we saw in all these games. Like, for example, Utah's double overtime upset over Boston University. That's not a league game. Those were two teams that maybe if they had played in late February, the outcome would have been more widely spread. And then because the practices are a little bit more consistent, some of the COVID protocol issues have been sorted out with a bunch of teams, you start to see the gaps between some of these squads shrinking. And I think that's really healthy for the ecosystem overall.
Yeah, now the improvement rate, it can change and varies dramatically, especially this year with teams who had less than perfect beginnings to their January and February, had some postponements and cancellations. You see some teams hitting their stride maybe a little later than typical. And then you see others who maybe have peaked and need to kind of go back and develop layers of success, you know, start generating some depth of scoring, start mixing in some different defensive packages, start giving maybe a little more playing time to freshmen and sophomores.
Let's start in the Carrier Dome, where the Notre Dame Fighting Irish emerged with an 18-11 victory over the Orange. This was the noon ESPNU game, a marquee contest. Pat Cavanaugh, 4 goals and 5 assists. Will York inserted into the starting lineup as the lefty finisher after having a breakout game against Virginia a week prior. Replaces Mikey Drake and scores 4 goals. Syracuse led by Stephen Rafis with 3. But really, when you look at the fact that Notre Dame's defense, and really, I think the combination of defense and the face-off prowess, which, you know, it was a two-headed monster once again. Kyle Gallagher, 15-22. I don't know if he goes by Charles or Charlie Leonard, but either way, 8 of 10. Chuck Leonard added a goal to that stat line. You know, just not only an important bounce-back win for the Fighting Irish after suffering a 1-goal loss at home in their ACC opener against Virginia a week prior, but also, to me, the demonstration of growth. And when I look at the ACC, the most interesting question is, it's pretty clear Duke and Carolina sit atop the pack. The question is, where are their tiers? Where are their tier lines? And how wide are those tiers? It is possible, given that we saw, I will say this, before we saw Notre Dame go into the Dome and put a one-sided win against the Orange, because we had seen Syracuse with a one-sided win over Virginia, and we had seen them play a 1-goal game against Duke, it was possible that the top tier was Duke, Carolina, and Syracuse. Then there was a gap, and then there was Virginia and Notre Dame. Now, I feel like this result suggests that either there are two tiers, or there's a little bit less separation between the top and the bottom than we might have expected coming into the season and what we might have seen.
Going into this game, I looked at it and said, you know, if Notre Dame doesn't bounce back, they're going to back themselves into a corner where they may not win another game again. Well, they answered. As you made a very astute point, they took the best of what they showed against Virginia and put it all together in this game. Now you turn to Syracuse saying, oh my gosh, with that faceoff and that defense, with those two liabilities, where are they going to get wins in the league from the rest of the year on? They play Albany on Thursday in a game that's televised, I believe, on the ACC network. But so suddenly things can change in this league. But I think what we saw is teams making that step, taking the next positive step, whether it was Virginia emboldened, confidently handling Richmond, got out of the gate really strong, played at a fast tempo, got a lot of different guys involved in the scoring, or whether it was Notre Dame. Again, don't judge your performance by wins and losses. And there was a lot of positives to take out of that Notre Dame home loss to Virginia. It was their first step up against great competition. Will York came in off the bench on the extra man, scored. Well, they put him in the lineup this week. That makes sense. Kavanaugh, he's got to be considered as the fourth best player in the country right now, behind Gray, Sowers, and Bernhard. Why not Kavanaugh for an invite to Washington, D.C. for the Tuaritan? I put him and Brendan Nickturn probably in that next tier of players. We know what they can do defensively. Entenmann is good. There are times in that game when he moves pipe to pipe that he falls down and he doesn't have great balance. He still is a work in progress.
I've got questions. But the faceoff guys. I really like him, but I've got questions. And it's the type of situation where it's like, and I think you saw this.
When you move him, his fundamentals fly out the window. When he's a stationary goalie, square to the shooter, he's outstanding. He's big. He's quick. He sees the ball well. He's got good instincts. When you move him pipe to pipe, he's flopping all over the place. He loses his base. He falls down on his hip. He needs to really work on his turns. That is, from back to front, from side to side, and maintaining the integrity of his stance on his turns. Again, just watch your replays in that game. Any cross crease feed, he's like falling down and grasping at straws. You pump him, and he just needs to hold his integrity a little better. And that can come with practice.
So what do you take away from Syracuse coming away from this one?
Syracuse has got issues. They got the worst face-off unit in the league. And this is a league that's not forgiving. There are very few games in this league that you're going to be able to win when you're minus 10 in possessions. They were minus 10 against Duke. They got lucky that Duke played an atrocious defensive game that day. And it was a one-goal Syracuse loss. This time, Notre Dame's not as forgiving. What were the possession stats in this game this weekend in the Dome? They never really showed the full possession stats, but I'm guessing that Cuse was at least a minus 10 in total possessions. And that's putting intense pressure on a defense that doesn't have a number one stopper, a goalie who is hit or miss, very good one week, really not good the next week. And then shorties who are getting run into the ground, and you could see fatigue really become a factor in the 45th minute of that game. So no faceoffs, don't have a stopper, playing far too much defense in a league that's not going to be forgiving.
Notre Dame had 42 possessions in this game, and one of the most telling stats, Syracuse failed 5 clears. They had 24 possessions. So they were at a 21 possession disadvantage coming away from this
21 game. Possession disadvantage. You got no shot. I mean, it's as simple as that. If you're going to lose all those faceoffs, you got to cause some turnovers. You got to clear the ball perfectly. You can't foul. You got to shoot a high percentage. That's kind of what they did against Duke. They converted on 48% of their possessions in that game. And that's, you know, thinking that same approach is going to work long term, it's just not going to happen.
Let's move on to the best game of the day on Saturday for my money. Lehigh 13, Army 12. This was a game where Mike Sisselberger, the faceoff specialist, was very much a integral part of the storyline, winning 23 of 27 possessions. I thought that as a result, Brendan Nickturn really powered an Army offense that just knew that it had a small margin of error, but late, I was impressed by James Pryor. Two of those losses came in the last three faceoffs and gave Army an opportunity to come back from a 2-goal deficit late in the game to tie it up. Ultimately, the answer came from Cole Kirst, who looks like an absolute monster, and Kevin Cassis, talking to McAneer postgame, talked about how his confidence and his shooting have really come into their own. And then ultimately the game, I think, was decided by two James Spence saves that were really kind of scramble efforts out of the Lehigh defense. And let me tell you, so Lehigh scores to go up one with, I don't know exactly how much time was left. I want to say it was like in the 30-ish second range. Definitely fewer
11,
than 80 10 seconds.
11-10 or
12-11? Yeah. No, to go up 13-12. So they score the eventual game winner. Then Sisselberger wins.
Army tied it up, I think, at 3:46.
Okay.
And then they scored the game winner with 2 and change to go on the clock.
So, obviously, if that's indeed the case, you can't kill the possession. That being said, there was a Sisselberger shot. Then there was a Lehigh offensive shot. I believe it was Tommy Schelling turning the corner, had more or less an empty net, took the shot, missed. Then Army comes down. Spence gets a save. Lehigh gets an opportunity to clear, and they fail the clear. That was, I was just like, if they lose this game, Kevin Cassis is going to absolutely lose his mind, because three different opportunities to potentially seal the victory all fell short. It required one more Spence save, and then, you know, kind of goalies playing ping pong end to end. And I thought that ultimately it was just an awesome, really exciting game that for stretches in the middle was a little bit plodding, but had a great finish.
I'm watching right now as we record this on Sunday, I'm watching Peter Milliman get after the Hopkins Blue Jays. Like, I've never seen Milliman get after a team before in his times at Cornell and so far this season. You know, again, Army, I thought faceoffs were a big storyline this weekend, Terry. There's a bunch of games that had big faceoff margins, whether it was Loyola, whether it was Lehigh, whether it was Notre Dame. I thought across the board, the teams, Denver again did it. So faceoffs, but Army deserves a lot of credit for competing and scrapping and causing turnovers and doing a decent job on the non-faceoff ground balls. Nick Turn had a big game for the Cadets, and they fought back. And I think if that game went another 5 or 10 minutes, I get the feeling that they were kind of turning things. They were finishing as the better team, where Lehigh kind of started the game as the better team. But it's a big win for Lehigh. Again, it's only temporary, but it puts them atop the Patriot League, which is an awesome race this year. You know, with Army, obviously, Lehigh on top. They're a top 10 team right now. Army, I still have at around the 9, 10, or 11 range. And then you got Loyola still on the top 20, even though they lost to Towson a week ago. And then Navy's improving. You know, their growth was a little stunted by the shutdown at the Naval Academy. But I love the Patriot League this year. I think it's intriguing. And I think, you know, Army's got a nice D. They're one area, again, like Cuse, you know, the face-off, if you're going to spot a team, all those extra possessions. And that's what Lehigh's done well this year. You look at Lehigh's numbers, great face-off percentage, great shooting percentage, high in the scoring margin. They've been dusting everybody. They just continue to move the ball well. I love their passing on offense.
So you are talking about the Patriot League in whole. What's interesting is that this year the Patriot League is actually divided into two divisions, North and South. And where a bunch of leagues used COVID as an opportunity to expand their postseason, like, for example, the Big Ten, all six teams are getting into the Big Ten tournament. They're playing quarterfinals, 3 versus 6, 4 versus 5. The Patriot League went the opposite direction, and what is typically a 6-team tournament is now a 4-team tournament. The top two finishers in the North qualify, the top two finishers in the South. And as a result, Loyola, by virtue of having lost to Lehigh already, had a backs against the wall game against Navy. If they had lost to Navy, they would have been eliminated from Patriot League tournament contention. And conversely, if Navy loses to Lehigh in their game that's upcoming, they will be eliminated from Patriot League tournament consideration. So Army, clearly the favorite in the North. BU, who lost to Army 12-10, is otherwise 3-1 in, well, not otherwise, they are 3-1 in the Patriot League. And it seems like they're probably not going to get challenged for that second spot. So I'm guessing that Lehigh beats Navy and the Patriot League tournament is going to be set in a couple of weeks, and it's going to be Army and Boston University representing the North, and Lehigh and Loyola representing the South. And, you know, that's probably good for the teams in the sense that, you know, it kind of assists their RPI. But as we talked about last week, as we heard from committee chair Tim Leonard, with respect to how much the traditional metrics are going to matter, might not be the core consideration. The core consideration might just be, let's win this AQ and take it out of the committee's hands and not worry about it. We'll see. It's a really interesting race to consider that, you know, some of these team seasons are going to be over much earlier in the calendar with a lot fewer games under their belt than in a typical year.
Yeah. And I would encourage fans who are interested in predicting an NCAA tournament, some of the at-large selections, to just look at the schedules. You know, Loyola, to their credit, they still have a game against Georgetown. I think that Towson game is going to come back to haunt them big time. And then Army has the win over Cuse. I'm not sure if anyone else in the league has any remaining games of merit on their schedule. BU losing to Utah over the weekend certainly doesn't help any kind of league RPI.
100%. You brought up a topic that's not related to a game, but that I do want to address just because we're kind of at the mid-season mark and it's the appropriate time. The face-off. Now, when the face-off rule changed and eliminated the moto grip, one of my criticisms of the committee was, what problem are you trying to solve? And we don't have a clear answer to that question. But it's certainly perceived that one of the problems that's trying to be solved is the dominance. And you talked about, if that is in fact one of the things that this rule change was meant to prevent, it is not working. You can also use that point to say, well, then the rule changes weren't that big of a deal. If the best faceoff guys are still the best faceoff guys and TD Erland's going 100% or whatever, then eliminating the moto grip wasn't that big of a deal. Where do you come down on that topic without a full season's worth of data to analyze?
I was never under the thought pattern that that dominance led to a rule change. I was under the thought pattern that long extended draws where two Fogos would remain engaged and intertwined and circular and driving the ball into the sod for 45 seconds, that was what they wanted to get rid of. They wanted to get the ball out and get it in play.
I don't know where on the record that is somebody saying off the record.
Well, I mean, that's conversations I've had with two high ranking coaches, one of them who was actually on the committee.
So I had a conversation with a coach on the committee, and he told me one of his primary motivations was reducing the influence of face-off specific heads being able to win matchups versus other face-off heads. Now,
yeah, no, that would be a valid that I would, and I would agree with that. There's no reason that one bat should hit more home runs with one bat than the other, and that the team with the good bat wins every game. The team with the better hockey stick wins. Like that's not a good sport when that happens.
Well, I mean, is there a better example of that having happened in any sport than the advantage the titanium handles presented Princeton in the mid-90s?
Well, they took the tip out of basketball, Terry, because the tall guy had won every tip. I mean, you know, this is not these things happen.
So my question is, has it worked? Do we know whether face-off heads are still as influential in winning a face-off as they apparently were in the preceding 3 or 4 years?
No, the dominant Fogos are still dominant. I don't have a problem with that. The game just looks like it should. The ball's getting out. These players are more athletic. If you watch a Tucci, a Tyre, a Naso, these guys actually can handle the ball and they're making plays. They're staying on the field. They're not clamping on the ball, flipping it to themselves like that one gross year we had, where everyone was pinching, plunging, and the ball was still stuck in their stick, and they're running down the field with it in the back of their stick. I mean, that was bizarre. That was bizarro land, because that wasn't lacrosse. I think we're back, and I hope they leave it the way it is. It's very good, and the good face-off guys will continue to be great, and that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And the more they stay on the field, the more offensive impact they can have. That's great, too. I love that.
One of the other big outcomes of Saturday evening, a game that fewer people probably saw than should have been because it was going up against a NCAA tournament semifinal, Baylor's one-sided win over Houston. Rutgers 10, Ohio State 9, Adam Charlambides was really kind of the straw that stirred the drink, so to speak, for the Scarlet Knights with 3 goals and an assist. Jack Myers playing, in my opinion, his best game of the season with 4-1. But ultimately, this game came in way lower scoring than you would have expected. Colin Kirst, 15 saves, 9 goals allowed. Alec Vandebovekamp, 11 saves. And the faceoff advantage, very clearly in Justin Anasio's favor, 17 of 22. So very much Ohio State able to dictate the tempo. And I thought that they did a nice job of effectively grinding down the pace.
I didn't realize there was basketball on last night because I watched the last quarter and a half of the Rutgers-Ohio State game waiting for the 7:30 Olympic trials, which were unbelievable. Gable Steveson, Kyle Dake, all my guys from the college coverage. But I, you know, Ohio State's a dramatically better team when Ryan Tarasenko plays. I think they're a top 20 team when Ryan's in the lineup. I don't think they're a top 15 team, but right now I slotted them in somewhere between 15 and 20. They look much better with him in the lineup. It's just the way it is. Faceoff dominance though really define this game. Once again, Rutgers can't win a faceoff, and I don't understand. Like, good luck against Maryland. Good luck in the playoffs. They call themselves NASCAR. I read about this in my column on Monday. There was nothing NASCAR about them. You can't be NASCAR when you lose every face off and you don't have the ball. Thankfully, their goalie.
They're drag racing.
Thankfully, it's nothing. They're racing from behind. It's like,
well, right. Isn't that what drag racing is? You're at a standstill, and then you just try to go as fast as you can, and sometimes your car flips over.
So there was nothing. You know, look, I like Rutgers a lot. They showed a lot winning this game, quite honestly, because they could have lost this game. They really could have. Ohio State was much better with Tarasenko. Ohio State scored at times. Rutgers wouldn't flinch. They deserve a lot of credit here. Goaltending was strong. Sherlin Bettis showed up at the end. They're still very much, if Rutgers is going to take the next step, and they can. Look, they're a very good team. I still got them in the top 10. They need to develop more depth of scoring. They're so heavily reliant on their top five. There's a massive drop-off if you look at their numbers. After Knobloch and Sprock plus the first attack, it's like this abyss. And great teams, you know, Maryland's a little top-heavy themselves, but great teams are going to have 6, 7, 8 scores. If you compare Duke and North Carolina's depth of scoring, 6 guys in double figure, 7 guys, you know, who regularly can score. So I think that's an area of work in progress. But again, Jersey boys, bada bing, bada boom, bada bang, whichever way you want to say it.
I mean, not that way.
That's a big win. That's a big win because, you know, getting fired up for that home game, I thought there might be a little letback. We've beaten this team. I give them credit. I give them credit. They gritted out a nice home win.
Staying in the Big Ten, Maryland 17, Penn State 10. Looking at the box score, I didn't get eyes on very much of this game at all, but Mark Sickler, a goal and 3 assists for the Nittany Lions. I don't know who Mark Sickler is. So certainly a storyline to keep an eye on when it comes to what the Nittany Lions will be relying on going forward. But the storyline from this game was Jared Bernhardt becoming the all-time goal-scoring leader in Maryland Terrapin history, surpassing Matt Rambo's record. We've talked about the Bernhardts on this podcast before, but it feels like an appropriate time to give you an opportunity to say a little something about Jared.
Well, no, as we've talked about earlier, you know, he wanted to play football this year. That's kind of what his dad was a football coach. He was my defensive coordinator. He worked his way up, Jimmy Bernhardt, to college, coached at Hofstra and then Brown, where he met Coach O'Brien, and he got involved with the George O'Leary coaching tree. So he coached at UCF, and then beyond that with Penn State, and then with the Houston Texans. And I've been close with Jimmy for 35 years. Just an amazing man, a mentor of mine. He passed away. Jared wanted to play football. That's not happening with the pandemic. So he comes back for this final season. And I think Jared's in a great spot right now, mentally, physically, emotionally. And he's playing, you know, A-level ball. When you look at what Maryland is doing, their shooting is just insane. You know, look at their numbers, Terry. 40% as a team. Their top four guys, like Wisnowskis, Bernhardt, and Long, are all 40 to 45% guys. And then Maltz is 65%. I've never seen a team with all top four scores with numbers like that. I mean, please, somebody find me a stat sheet that's even comparable. It's really incredible, their efficiency. They don't waste shots. It's all dunks.
That credit goes to Bobby Benson, right?
I guess so. I mean, to keep it simple, you watch him on tape, and I'm not even exactly sure it's – Their spacing's usually ideal. They're willing to make the extra pass. When they do jam the ball inside, it's usually well designed. It's not to a guy who's covered. They don't take bad shots in transition. They're just playing really within themselves. You know, they don't rush, but they're not going too slow like they had, you know, 10 years ago. I just think they're really comfortable in their roles, and there's a lot to like. Their defense continues to be terrific off the ground, so that's creating more one-and-done defensive possessions. They're getting solid goaltending. I thought the big storyline of this game was, so they had a new Fogo. They had, was it Wireman? Not looking at it. I'm not by my computer.
You just put me right on the spot with a question that I don't know the answer to. So yeah, Maryland unveiled a new Fogo to go up against Arcari? Yeah, apparently, Luke Wireman took 23 draws. Yeah. He won 12 exactly. 23.
Who is Luke Wireman? That's this podcast question of the week, folks.
Well, I mean, it's this game's question of the week because I already asked, who's Mark Sickler? We'll do a little research. We'll get back to you next week. I want to move on to a couple of the big mid-major outcomes that are going to be really substantial when it comes to the conference races. UMBC 10, Vermont 8. This puts essentially a three-way tie at the top of the America East. UMBC, Stony Brook, and Vermont all 4-1. The difference being that UMBC's loss came to Binghamton. They have wins over both the Seawolves and, obviously, by virtue of their performance on Saturday, over the Catamounts as well. This game nominally qualifies as an upset, but might suggest that maybe we just aren't giving enough credit to the Retrievers, especially their defensive prowess, to be able to hold this Catamount offense to 8 goals seems like a notable outcome.
Cuts the Catamounts' production in half, team averaging 15 or 16 per. Ryan Moran and his group, Coach Ryan Moran, doing a great job. This is the best start in Catonsville since 1992 or 94-ish. So we're talking 20 years.
And there were a couple of really good tournament teams in that span of time.
Yeah, they didn't get off to the starts back then. That was because they played, you know, these crazy non-conference schedules where UMBC would play Loyola, Towson, Maryland, Navy, you know, whoever. But the defense for UMBC, and it's a league with good scoring. I mean, Stony Brook can score, Albany can score, Vermont can score. I'm fascinated in the way this is going to shake itself down. I think they play Albany next, and they might even play Albany after on a short week for Albany, coming off that Thursday game against Cuse. But UMBC's in the mix. Now,
well, hold on. Before you move on from UMBC, I just want to make one relatively subtle but super important shout-out to Ryan Moran and his staff, because the subtext of the comment is really important. Jameson Kesterer was this team's defensive coordinator last year. He got hired by Johns Hopkins, and now he is working for Pete Milliman's staff. They did not replace him. There are only two full-time coaches on UMBC's men's lacrosse staff. It's Ryan Moran and Joe Bucci. Craig Chick is the volunteer assistant, and it's just the three of them.
Wow. They got some young players who are now emerging who scored some big goals in this game. And this is going to be fascinating. Again, the challenge to rank 13 through 20 in any poll, UMBC is a team that I think I had in or close to being in last week, maybe 18, 19, 20. I could argue that they could be as high as 13 this week behind Delaware because they have those two wins you mentioned. And those are really good wins.
Totally. Yeah, so, I mean, to your point, really good things happening in Catonsville. And, I don't know, you know, Nick Griffin is somebody who has been kind of talked about as one of the better defenders in the league for a while. Ethan Robinson has gotten a lot of attention. So very clearly, there's a lot of talent on this, but they're also playing cohesively. Mason Edwards is a short 60 midi that I've loved. We put him up for a player of the year or player of the week nominee a couple weeks ago. Just a lot of talent and guys playing together. Nick Dupuy is the leading scorer with 23 points in 6 games. They're not winning games by their offensive outputs, but they have a relatively broad distribution of scoring, and it's clicking. And you're right, their next game is against Albany, so they've got 8 days to prepare, whereas to what you said, the Great Danes head to Syracuse on Thursday at 5 on ACC Network.
That's right. So that's a little bit of an advantage for UMBC.
Moving along, a similar type of outcome, Hobart 11, Bryant 10. Bryant had been a top 20 team at points over the course of this season, including last week. And Tommy Mott, with 3 goals and an assist, leads the scoring for the Statesmen. They are now 3-1, also having suffered an extended pause. Their loss to LIU on March 13th was surprising and also a catalyst for LIU's really impressive start. They're at 5-2, although they're coming off of a loss this weekend, and they've racked up a couple of wins over teams that would be expected to finish near the bottom of the NEC. Hobart and Bryant both 3-1 in conference. St. Joe's 3-0, and as I mentioned, LIU 5-1 in the league.
Yeah, maybe a lesson that we shouldn't write teams off, especially those who have not had the opportunity to play as many games, like a Marist, like a Hobart, and some others, because, you know, that everyone deserves a shot here, and some teams may be late to the party, but that doesn't mean they can't dance in May.
No team was later to the party than the UMass Minutemen. They played their first game on March 14th, a 13-9 win over Fairfield. They backed that up with a 13-7 win over Drexel. Lost a one-goal Tuesday afternoon game to Albany, 13-12. Beat Hofstra 16-10 last week in a game that looked like it was really going to separate the Minutemen at the top of the conference. And then guess what? The Drexel Dragons handed Coach Greg Canella's team a 12-11 loss on Saturday afternoon. Sean Donnelly, the newcomer, 2 goals and 6 assists to pace the Dragon offense. Billy Philpott, 2-1. Devin Spencer, 1-2. Gabriel Prosek, 3 goals, but ultimately not enough to overcome Donnelly's day offensively for the Dragons.
And Dragon Breath may be better than we think. You know, they're hovering too. But what a wacky year for teams, as you said, UMass, Towson, Loyola, Albany. It's good game, bad game, good game, bad game, good game, bad game. And there's so many from ranked 13 through 30 that are now taking turns beating each other on a 7-day basis.
Quint, any other final thoughts as we wrap down? I guess that's true. That seems like a decent phrase. I'm going to start using that a little bit more. We haven't talked about Duke Carolina on Thursday night, which was an awesome game, but seems already a little bit outdated as there was such intense action on Sunday.
Yeah, no, it was a great week again. You know, these ACC games will continue to deliver. We got that, as you mentioned, Syracuse Albany on Thursday night at 5, ACC Network. Then over the weekend, you get 2 good ones, Notre Dame and Duke, and I believe Virginia Carolina. It's a doubleheader on ESPNU on Saturday. I will be going to Pittsburgh to cover the Hockey Frozen Four. That's a Thursday-Saturday format. You got 3 teams from Minnesota and the UMass Minutemen. Under Coach Greg Carville, working on my bios the last 2 days. I can't tell you, Terry, there's a half a dozen to a dozen athletes who have brothers or sisters competing in lacrosse. There's a strong crossover here between the hockey lacrosse athlete, whether it's in the Northeast or the Midwest, whether it's, again, brothers playing at Brown, brothers playing at Quinnipiac, sisters playing, at Sacred Heart. So there's a lot of crossover, so I'm excited to dive into this as a tier one tested daily reporter.
Well, enjoy the opportunity to cover a live event once again. Are you going to have to sleep in the bowels of the stadium this time?
No, the games are separated and it's going to be a late night when we're not facing off until 9 p.m. It's past my bedtime stuff. But, you know, last thing, Terry, the weather's perking up. Hopefully there's a lot of youth leagues and high schools that are allowing athletes to practice or play. Some of these stadiums now are welcoming fans. It was great to see 1,253 people at the Maryland game. I'm thinking we're going to start to see partial attendance across the country. So everybody get out and support these games. Be safe. Keep it spread out. Enjoy the great weather if you're a player. Put in the extra time, whether it's in the backyard against the wall or before or after practice. At the end of the day, that's what's going to make you a great player.
Thanks as always for listening to the Quick Restart podcast. If you like what you heard, including my dog who barked intermittently throughout this podcast, leave a rating and review. Give Walter 1 star, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.